Hi, Sabrina George for New Comedy Radio, which is on the website, www.newcomedyradio.com, interviewing Ralph Brown, who I met working a very long time ago. Ralph, first question I ask everybody, what was your first action to become a performer?
My first action?
Yeah. Not thinking about it, when did you actually do something?
When I was about 10 years old, I played Joseph, which was, of course, one of the leading roles in the Nativity in my village hall.
I used to play Joseph a lot.
And I don't recall any great fear at doing that. And I don't recall being particularly funny either, but I'm sure I was quite funny. I'm sure we all were. And then I did a couple of plays at school, and I do remember the fear then, just before I went on stage, and then it evaporating as soon as I actually hit the stage. And then I went off to London to do a law degree, and at the end of the first year I didn't want to come home and I didn't want to spend the summer with my family because I was a dysfunctional little sod.
So where was home?
Home was Hailsham in East Sussex, and I was at the London School of Economics in halls of residence which chucked the students out at the end of term and rented them out to American tourists in the summer, so I didn't have anywhere to stay. And I saw an advert for audition for a play that was going to Edinburgh, and I auditioned, I got the part, and I went to Edinburgh, and that sort of took up my summer holidays.
And what was the play?
It was called The Death of Private Kowalski. I played an American recruiting sergeant. And I remember after one show in the toilet, some American tourist saying, "Which part of America are you from, Ralph?" And that was it.
That was the buzz.
Yeah.
So what did you do for the audition?
I wasn't going to be a lawyer after that.
What was the audition piece you did to get into the? I mean, what was your story to get in there? Surely they were looking for people who had some.
I can't remember that, you know. I've got big chunks of my life missing, and one of them is how I got that part. I think I may have had to have just read the speech from the actual place. I think we maybe turned up in the morning, got given our pages, and then got a couple of hours to look at it, and then we had to go and actually do pieces from the play rather than, because I didn't have any pieces, I didn't have anything ready, you know.
Which is what's normal when
so
you go for auditions.
I think we just had to read the play.
And what was your accent then? Where did you get that from? Fellow student or?
I can't remember that either, but I think just out of my head, you know. Just kind of generic American. The sort of really striking thing about that summer was having conversations with people my own age who were saying, "So what are you going to do when you leave college, Ralph?" And I was like, "Well, I'm going to be a barrister, you know." And what are you going to do? And they were like, "I'm going to be an actor." And it never, literally, if you can believe this, at the age of 19, it never occurred to me that one could be an actor. It was just something that you did after school or at weekends. It was a fun thing to do, rather like playing football or playing cards, something like that.
It was a hobby.
It was something that you just fitted into your. It was a sort of fun. It wasn't work was work and fun was fun. And so I never kind of joined those two things up. I would never have thought about being an athlete or a professional footballer or a, you know, clothes designer or, you know what I mean? It's like our school was very, very about, you know, medicine and law and, you know, history and geography and economics and that kind of thing. And the school was in Lewes, which is just up the road, 7 miles away. And suddenly there was all these kids, I was surrounded by all these kids, I'm going to be an actor. I was like,
this was in Edinburgh.
And I just thought, yeah, that's what I'm going to be as well.
And so did you ask them what you needed to do or anything, or did you just...
Well, I thought I ought to finish the degree for reasons of parental pressure and my own self-esteem, I suppose. I didn't really want to drop out and start acting, and maybe I didn't have the confidence to do it. So I finished the degree, so I do have a degree in law.
So how long did it take from doing your Edinburgh to finishing the degree? Did you have another year to go?
Or another 2 years to go.
Oh, you did? So you went through another 2 years, and did you every holiday whiz off and try and find some acting to do?
Indeed. Not every holiday, but every summer I went to Edinburgh, yeah.
To do something?
With the same gang, yeah.
Hey.
And kept in touch with that National Student Theatre Company it was. And did a few more shows with them, and with other people that I'd met up in Edinburgh, and... you know, my first professional job in London was with people I'd met in Edinburgh, kind of thing. So it kind of did ripple through everything else. I didn't actually start acting properly, professionally, till I was 25. So there's a big gap between that Edinburgh and actually starting work.
I think there's a big gap anyway with most drama students in between starting real work.
Yeah.
But you had the extra degree in between. So did you do things like evening courses at the City Lit, which is the big drama play? You did all that as much as possible?
Did that, and I actually applied for the Bristol Old Vic one-year course, didn't get in, applied to the Ealing drama school, whatever it's called, I can't remember.
Questers?
No.
Theatre? No.
No, the Drama Something Studio, something like that.
I don't know.
But they were the only, there's only 2 one-year courses in the UK, and I got into that one. And because I didn't want to do another 3 years of anything, do you know what I mean? And I couldn't get a grant. Of course, this was in the days when one was given a grant to go to university and didn't have to pay it back. The lucky generation. Of baby boomers, and I couldn't. East Sussex refused to give me a grant. Said, "No, you've had your grant. You can't get another one just because you feel like being an actor." So I didn't go and do that course. I went to work instead, and sort of auditioned and did fringe theatre for no money around London. And
were you working as a lawyer at that point?
No, I was working in an office.
Right, just a cash in hand type job.
No, proper salaried job.
Right.
Working for the Society of Industrial Artists and Designers on the Mall. Actually, Carlton House Terrace, just above the ICA. I was the membership secretary for a whole year. Before that, I was working at the Scala Cinema in Tottenham Street, which is where became Palace Pictures later, and met Steve Woolley and a whole load of people that I would work with later on as an actor. And that was only because my halls of residence at the London School of Economics was just up the road from the Scala Cinema. So I wandered down, I was sort of film fanatic, and said, can I tear tickets here? And they were like, yeah. So I tore tickets in there for years and ended up working in the coffee bar, working on the all-nighters on Saturday nights.
Which were fabulous in my memory.
Mm. And all the tribes would come down. And I distinctly remember meeting Boy George, who had combed his very, very long hair up into a point above his head. This kind of extraordinary kind of figure with a white face and this kind of pointed head, who had to bend down to come through doors. And the most incredible clothes, and all those new romantic kids. And then skinheads would go down there and Hell's Angels. And, you know, it was a kind of meeting, it was a kind of neutral meeting place for sort of tribes to come and have coffee and speed and whatever else they were on.
Well, that's what I remember, is going upstairs on and get assorted brownies and coffee, I think, I can't remember, and staying through the night on a Cocteau movie spin.
Exactly.
Hours and hours and hours, God knows why, but it was brilliant.
And coming out at sunset. It was a washout, you know. But yeah, and that was my.
So at that point, were you very much. I'm just trying to get your state of mind. Were you still, like, you wanted to be an actor, and were you sort of like engaging with these people's activities, or were you very much the outsider looking on, just going, aren't these people interesting?
I knew I was going to be an actor.
Right.
And I was kind of biding my time. I felt at that point that as soon as I started working as an actor, I had this image of a horse in a horse race in a sort of I don't know what those things are called where they put the horses, but before the race they kind of put them in
the paddock.
Yeah, no, before, but after that, then they kind of put them in a box.
Oh, yeah, with the gates open, yeah.
Springs open, yeah. And I felt like I was kind of in, I was wandering around, and once I was in, and I had these blinkers on my eyes, and I wouldn't be able to really look around at the world once I started work. It was kind of a weird image, but that's what I felt. It was like going to be some kind of race, and I'd have to be fit, and I'd have to be really focused. And so I felt like in my early 20s, I was doing a bit of travelling and doing a bit of hanging out and not really working on what I wanted to do, but actually just collecting information.
Getting ready.
Yeah.
And were all the other people at Palace Pictures feeling the same way, that were working, that then I went on to form Palace Pictures, Steve Woolley and that, like, would you sit in corners talking passionately about movies?
About films, and, very much. Yeah, everyone was passionate about films, and I don't remember them talking about making films. I'm not going to pretend we all sat around and said, let's make movies, because we didn't, but there was a lot of looking back, kind of ambitious people there, and sort of arty, affected, pretentious people, and you know, I was one of them. You know, and it was fun. I was squatting for a lot of that period as well, and I was a right mess, really, looking back on it. Messing around with speed, and ended up going to Mexico with my brother to get off the speed, and also just to do some travelling, and caught hepatitis B, which was really serious. And I was off drink for a whole year, and I was in Coppetswood Hospital trying to recover from that, and it was just kind of, I was just totally dysfunctional, I think, at that point in my life.
But thinking you were in the gates, getting ready to go.
Yeah, knowing what I was going to do, absolutely not in any question that I was going to do it. It was just a question of sort of how it was going to happen, and eventually read a thing in Stage, went and auditioned for this socialist feminist theatre company called Moving Parts, and they offered me a job, and I had to. It was a job that meant I had to leave my job, and so I handed in my notice, and everyone in the office was like, "Yeah, Ralph's going to be an actor, hooray!" You know, because they all knew that was what I wanted to do. So that was it, really. I haven't looked back since then. I did three tours with Moving Parts.
Is that what, touring around colleges, schools, theatres?
Touring around unemployment centres, youth clubs, schools, and unemployment drop-in centres. I mean, it was aimed at teenagers. The plays were written by the women who ran the theatre company, and I, in fact, ended up co-writing one. And then it was one of those classics where you get to the end of the play and everyone's bowing, and then you go, "Thank you very much, everybody. Now we'd like to get into small groups. We're going to come around and talk to you about what you've just seen and what it all means and how you feel about it yourselves." Right, so, Johnny, what do you feel about racism?
I just want more heroin.
Yeah. Well, this is pre-heroin. There was no heroin.
Oh, really?
Then,
oh, really?
No, this is like 1984.
So these are what we call the proper unemployed.
1983, this was like Thatcher's Britain.
Yeah,
I mean,
they just were millions and millions, yeah.
You know, we'd had the Brixton riots and all that stuff, and it was, you know, it was kind of...
Were you touring?
Political times, actually, you know.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
It was very political, and we were this kind of agitprop gang in a little Ford Transit van. We had to put our own sets up, you know, we moved the pool table over to one side. "Hey, what are you doing?" "We're doing theatre tonight." "Ah, bloody fear, yeah." You know, Chuck Pelham is at you while you're on stage. And, you know, we was kind of bold and brave what we were doing, and, you know, eventually got my equity card. On the third tour, the wages were got up to the 95 quid a week, which was the equity minimum, and that meant we all had equity contracts. Up to that point, we'd been on... I think first tour was 40 quid, second tour was 60, and then it was 95.
How long was the tour for?
They were like 3 months.
Right.
And all over...
And so what, you come off tour, start writing and rehearsing for another show and start again. So yeah. You just virtually had an almost unbreakable 9 months. Well,
yeah.
My 9 months was breaks for writing. And did you feel, what was your sort of feeling at the time? Did you think, this is it, I feel, this is my forte, I'm quite happy with it. Or did you feel slightly, well, this is not quite what I was...
No, I was right in the middle of my life.
You're really happy with that, right.
Yeah. Completely committed to the work. I completely believed in it. And, you know, that I don't think I'd have been given a job if I didn't. It was one of those companies where they did ask you about Ireland and about, you know, whatever, really, about politics before you... Because that was the raison d'etre of the whole theatre company.
Mm.
And all the people who booked the theatre company in the regions knew that and felt the same way. So it was very much a kind of a network of kind of socialist people.
And you'd carry on talking about it afterwards in the bar and...
Absolutely.
Whatever was required, yeah. So
and
it showed
up. Can we change the show? Can we take that bit out and put that in? And that bit's not working, that bit's not clear because everyone keeps saying this, you know. So it was always on the go, you know. Yeah.
Happy times.
And then,
and then what happened? Did you sort of move on to other things or did they disband? What stopped that?
No, they carried on. I felt after I'd written a play, and I didn't tour with the last one, I toured with the first two, and then the third one I wrote it, and I didn't tour with it. I became the administrator, because that was another kind of moving role in the company. I seem to remember that the World Cup was on at the time, that's probably why I didn't want to go on tour. So I stayed back in London, administrated the company, and watched the World Cup on TV. So that would have been the 84 World Cup in Spain, I guess. No, and I just thought, you know, I'd been in that company for a year, I didn't want to do it anymore, so I just thought I was just going to launch out. So I just said, right, thanks, I'm off now, and left. Didn't have anything to go to, just left. Just wanted to just, and I've done that loads of times, looking back on my life, I've just left things and just gone into the great void, and not knowing what was going to happen next.
Sort of felt the time of that thing, whatever it was, had come to its end for you.
Mm.
Not any bad feeling or anything, just to move on to something else, whatever that might be.
Yeah.
And what, you were living in a squat?
By then I was living in Finsbury Park with my girlfriend, and you know, I was just at the dawn of my working life, really. I was actually in pretty good shape, you know.
And then what happened?
Then I did A Clockwork Orange.
Had you got an agent by that time?
No.
No. And how did you get Clockwork Orange?
Because John Godber, who was directing it, I'd met him and a group of people called the Yorkshire Actors in Edinburgh, who were doing these kind of quite expressionist kind of pieces of work, quite physical theatre. I can't remember how did this happen. I think maybe somebody had dropped out and they just knew about me. They'd seen me in various plays. John Godber had been involved in the National Student Theatre Company as well, and was for many, many years before Hull Truck and all that stuff.
Just for those who don't know, Hull Truck is John's self-proclaimed National Theatre of the North. Mm. Some very, how would you call it, very prolific and busy theatre in Hull that works with lots of new writers, lots of new actors, lots of new everything. Very dynamic, very exciting.
Yeah, and John, of course, is the most published playwright in the UK, actually.
I think it's in the world, in the English language, he's the most performed.
Most performed and most published, I think.
Yeah, phenomenal.
More than Shakespeare or something stupid like that. Yeah.
Really daft statistic.
And he's just a very sweet but quite macho Yorkshireman. So, and he's doing A Clockwork Orange. So of course all these friends and feminists came down to see me in a in a pub called The Man in the Moon on the King's Road.
That's where I met you. Yeah.
doing this just repulsive, really, bit of Anthony Burgess bollocks called A Clockwork Orange, which is kind of intellectual wank, really, and it's just an excuse for guys to just be, you know, ultra violent and have loads of loud Beethoven playing. And so they were shocked. I remember meeting them in the pub and saying, "Ralph, what are you doing? What are you doing this play for? After doing a whole year of moving parts, what are you doing? What's wrong with you?" Like, they thought I'd gone mad, you know.
Really? Because my experience, I absolutely loved it, because I didn't, it was sort of my first proper thing. I still don't even know how I got it, but I was given the title of stage manager, and I didn't know what a stage manager was.
Yeah.
And I had most of the Yorkshire guys and John staying in my flat, because they had nowhere to stay, and I thought I was part of the job. And Pete Jeeves sewing up his trousers, and I just thought it was fantastic. I loved the whole thing. I never saw it as somewhere that was a piece of tosh. I mean, in one perspective, I see what you mean, but I mean, it was very dramatic. I mean, it was a new theatre on the wrong side of King's Road. No one had ever been there before, and we were getting people returning after the third show.
Were you there at the first rehearsal?
I can't remember. Again,
well,
it's...
The first rehearsal is us sitting around, and John comes in and goes, "Okay, everybody. This show is going to be the next Rocky Horror. We're taking the King's Road by storm. Let's go." It was like kind of any given Sunday, you know what I mean? It was a sort of sporting, he was an inspiring director, definitely, no two ways about it.
Yes, my memory is of first meeting John, because I had green hair at the time for my own personal reasons, I'm sure, and John just going, "We'll have none of that green haired shit in this place," meaning you're on the King's Road. And he wanted to go to nightclubs, which were... Because he was writing Bounces, I think, at the time, and he wanted me to take him to nightclubs, and what he thought nightclubs were and what I thought nightclubs were completely different. Mine were the idea of sort of darkened pits where nobody really spoke to each other. They just looked fabulous in the dark with something terribly sort of percussion-y in the background, and John's idea was the ones that we really sneered at and looked down on.
Yeah, handbags, dance around the handbags.
Yep. which he then wrote down into Bounces. So yeah, no, very happy memories. But there was a lot of confusion on my part because I thought that's how theatre was done. That was my first experience, and I thought it was terribly exciting. I thought it was fabulous. Mm. But all your feminist ladies were just like,
they were
shocked. Can't believe it. The amount of rape.
I just had to explain that I was an actor and that I was available for work. You know, and I wasn't actually going to turn my acting career into a political statement. I thought it was an exciting piece of work, rather like you.
Yeah.
But I did get an agent out of that show.
Did you?
I invited a whole bunch of agents. I can't remember where I got these names or whatever from. Maybe I wrote to every agent. You know, in those days I was quite into writing letters and putting photographs in them and sending them out, you know. So I may well have done that. Anyway, a guy called David Preston said he would look after me, who's a sort of velvet-wearing queen. He went into his office on Wardour Street. It was, the whole office was actually draped in velvet. And it was like a kind of, you know, a cavern of lechery, really. It's kind of silver, and he had these huge rings on his fingers. He was completely bald, old queen, and he went, "Ralph, do come in, sit down."
Was he wearing a suit or a dressing gown in velvet?
Kind of,
either,
know, both.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like a kind of that kind of vibe. And I wasn't in a position to pick and choose. So the only thing he ever did for me, I didn't stay with him very long, but he did get me the next job, which was the thing that kind of changed my life. And I can't remember, I must have heard from maybe Godber or somebody like that, that Berkoff was auditioning for his next show. I had seen, by this point, 1984...
Was it probably, Stephen Berkoff, yeah, for those who don't know. Yeah.
Stephen Berkoff, I'd seen three of Stephen Berkoff's plays, The Fall of the House of Usher, East, and...
Decadence?
No, it was before
right.
Decadence.
Okay.
That's funny, I can't remember. And I blew me away. He was, at that point, Stephen Berkoff was, for me, apart from Godber anyway, the only person working in English in this country on physical theatre. You know, and it wasn't all about the text, it was actually about the body and it was about the visuals. Most English theatre is about the text, thanks to dear old William Shakespeare.
Good man.
Who's kind of flattened the rest of theatre, really, because the word is paramount. Whereas Stephen had done work with Lindsay Kemp in Paris, and he was very much influenced by Grotowski and Thaddeus Cantor and all these people that I'd seen in Edinburgh and had been excited by. And then there was another theatre company called Impact, I think, who were from Leeds, Peter Brook, not the Peter Brook, another one, who were also mates of John Godber's, and they were very sort of physical based as well, and doing this kind of really exciting semi-dance type work, really, or sort of with mime, with kind of just using the body and using a lot more emotional kind of than just talking. And
what I find difficult to describe with physical theatre work is that it's got a real power, I mean real muscle to it, which dance doesn't necessarily have. Dance is deliberately sort of light-spirited, whereas a lot of the physical ghosts can get very, very dark with its physical. I mean, I don't know quite how to describe it to people who haven't seen it, what that quality is, but it's very specific. I mean, and Berkoff's probably the most extreme of that.
Mm. And funny as well. I always found his shows terribly funny.
There's one section where he's licking, he's playing a nasty, nasty skinhead with his Rottweiler, the dog, and he's sort of licking its nose, and I don't think he says anything, I can't really remember, but by the end he's actually gone inside the Rottweiler and come out of its arse, and the Rottweiler for a while is his skin, and he's just going, he's sort of going, I love you so much, that he's actually taken on the physicality of it. It was brilliant, absolutely brilliant, but that sort of, I thought, summed it up quite well. You can go very dark with it.
Yeah, very. So I'd heard Stephen Berkoff's auditioning for his new play, and I phoned up my velvet-clad agent and said, get me into that audition. I don't care how you do it, I don't care what you do, I've got to go. Got to get in. He said, I think they've finished those. I said, no, get me in. And he got me in 2 days later, showing up. He actually said, oh, yes, you can go in tomorrow. I said, great. Do I have to prepare anything? No, you just have to turn up. So Stephen was holding the auditions himself, and he was seeing us in batches of six.
In London.
Yeah. So the six of us would go in and he would line us up and he would make us improvise describing a punch-up that we had just seen. And it, and when he pointed out, you would talk, and when he pointed at the next person, you would shut up, and we just took it in turns like that. So it was amazingly competitive and kind of high energy. But anyway, I think three of the people in the six people that I was seeing that got cast, including me. It was just extraordinary. And there must have been scores of other gangs of six people going in. But maybe we all, the fact that, he's got a really strange way of working, Stephen, but I was absolutely overjoyed to be cast in that. And the play was West, which was the companion piece to East, and he was not going to be in it, he was going to direct it, which was thrilling. And then, you know, the first of many disappointments in my life, you know, when you actually get in the room, the first day of rehearsal, we're sitting around with the script, and we look at the script and we realise that there's Rory Edwards, who's playing the lead, and we know that, Rory is playing Mike, and then there's Bruce, Steve, me, and Ken, who are playing the gang. Then there's John Joyce and Stella Tanner, who are playing the mum and dad, and Sue Kidd, who's playing the girlfriend. But the gang, the lines in the play aren't corresponding to the four of us. There's just little random lines. There's somebody called Les, and there's somebody else called this. And what's going on here? And so Stephen goes, okay, he goes, you gang lads, just, you know, chip in when you feel like it and just start saying lines. It's just a read-through, so when you feel like saying a line, just say it, you know. So Bruce Payne just dives in and just says the whole two pages. And after two pages of listening to Bruce, I'm like, and he just sort of, he made the mistake of pausing to inhale, and I just was like, gudum, and I just went in there with the next bit, which was maybe half a page, and then it finished, and then it was another character's turn to talk. And we were all, then everyone's eyeing each other across the table, like, who's going to... And then, you know, I think Stephen got one line, Ken got one line, and it was back to Bruce, who got another page, because he just wouldn't stop. And then I kind of got fed up with that and muscled him out for another bit. This went on for 2 hours, was reading the play, it was like, sweaty, kind of tense, horrible read-through of like, the jungle, you know. At the end of which, Stephen goes... Lovely, thanks very much, everybody. Whichever lines you just said, they're your lines. See you tomorrow. And that was that. That was that. Never been so disappointed, more disappointed in my life at that point. Obviously, been much more disappointed since then. But and we rehearsed for 6 weeks, and the play was at the Donmar in the West End, and it was the shit hot hit of that year. It felt like it anyway, from being in it. It felt like everyone came to see it. Pop stars came to see it. You know, I mean, Elvis Costello and Madness came to see it. We were like...
This would have been, what, 85, 86?
84.
Right.
Yeah. And we ran for 5 months, and we then filmed it for Channel 4, which had just started. That would date it exactly. I can't remember when Channel 4 started, but we were... probably on the second week of Channel 4 or something like that. And so, of course, we thought, here we go, we've been anointed by Channel 4, we've been in the West End for 5 months, we're all going to be stars, darling. Yeah, and we thought that was it, that was the start.
And you were still doing the same lines that you'd done in rehearsal?
Yeah, the same one. On the first read-through, we're still doing the same lines. Bruce had the lion's share, of course, and the rest of us had less. And... none of us worked for, I certainly didn't work for 6 months after we finished that show. And that was my first lesson, that, you know, as you reach the top, there's only one way to go, you know. And
you were still with that agent, your velvet agent?
Yes.
Or had you got another one? You hadn't made a change?
No, I hadn't made a change, and I should have done at that point. But the fact that everybody had seen that show meant that eventually... you know, I was getting in for Royal Court and RSC and things like that, and I probably had even done some telly around here as well. Merry Wives of Windsor. So, you know, then the next job is a thing at the Royal Court, Danny Boyle directed, called Panic. a play with Ken, who was with me in West, also in a mad, brilliant play. And then, as a result of that, got cast in a play for Joint Stock Theatre Company, who no longer exist, who are a wonderful theatre company, a play about journalists called Deadlines. And it was while I was doing that play at the theatre, Royal Court Theatre upstairs, that my current agent came to see me in that, who was a friend of the director's, and said, yes, I'll represent you. And that was Michael Foster, and I've been with Michael Foster ever since.
And you're much more simpatico with each other.
Representing me for 24 years. Yeah, that's quite a long time. So maybe it was 83 then. My dates are crap. But anyway, I was playing six parts in that play. I was, you know, it was sort of typical Joint Stock play where you had to be... I was playing a striking miner, you know, a journalist at Radio Sheffield, Robert Maxwell, and, you know, I can't remember, somebody in Newsnight, you know what I mean? It's one of those kinds of plays where everyone did.
In fact, I worked on a number of things with them, and it was very, very cooperative as well.
Mm.
Everybody did a bit of everything with everybody.
And there wasn't an artistic director, there was a real collective.
Yeah.
And I actually went on to write a play for Joint Stock called Sanctuary, which was directed by Paulette Randall, who was the assistant director on Panic, Danny Ball's play. So that's where I met Paulette. Paulette's probably still my best friend in the business. Got very close because we worked on the play together, obviously, you know, which is not something I do every year. In fact, I haven't done it since. That's the only play I've ever written.
Is it?
Yeah.
All right. Mm. Despite doing something with the Movers and Shakers, whatever they were called in the beginning, I co-wrote
a play then, which I never really count, I suppose I should, but yeah. And I have written another play called Drive Away the Darkness, which is about my family, which got a reading at the National Theatre, but I always considered that Sanctuary, which is my Joint Stock play, which was a hip-hop musical about homeless teenagers set in London and Salisbury, was my play really, and that was the only play that I feel like I've kind of ever got off the ground really. And there was one of those moments where I thought, I could now stop acting and I could just write now. I won Samuel Beckett Award for the play, which is for the best first play, which is like a massive kind of pat on the back. But the people who sponsored the Samuel Beckett Award was Faber and Faber, Channel 4 and the Royal Court Theatre. Faber and Faber didn't publish it, Royal Court Theatre didn't commission me to write anything, and Channel 4 didn't commission me to
film
write
it, yeah.
Either, or film it. Yeah. So in fact, collectively, they all kind of went, you know, we don't like you very much. The actual judges of the award, which were a couple of writers, obviously did like me, but I think the people who sponsored it thought, we don't like that play. So I was kind of, I was discouraged at the same time as being encouraged. And didn't write anything for about 10 years after that. 8 years.
So then what happened?
Then I did The Bill, did a whole series of The Bill.
Right. And how was that?
It was really boring. It was, you know, you'd get the next episode and you've got to literally flick through it. It's the only lines you had.
So when, just to make sort of a bit of a leap here, you went from doing quite physical theatre, very full on, lots of very passionate theatre-y people around you at every single corner.
Mm.
Why did you go to The Bill? I mean, obviously it helps pay the rent and all that, but were there any other reasons that you went to do that?
I wanted to do films.
Right, you wanted to have something on your portfolio.
I wanted to work on camera. And it was around that time when I started realising, because I didn't know anything about anything, you know what I mean? I didn't have any entertainers or showbiz people in my family, and I literally had to learn it on the hoof. And that's when I started realising that that I could kind of drive it a little bit. I did have some choice. I wasn't just bobbing on the tide, that I could actually say no to things. And so I immediately said no to doing theatre in the provinces. I wasn't interested in, I had you know, with one exception, which I'll tell you about in a minute. And I wanted to be available for films. I just decided I wanted to do films. Mainly because I love going to see films. And that had been my teenage years of escape from my life and being in the cinema.
And did The Bill give you that? Did it give you that sort of grounding and confidence working on something like that to be able to work in front of
Probably, yeah.
Because it took
me years to get confidence enough, really. It's funny. But yeah, that was probably key, looking back on it.
Oh, right, it was part of the plan. Because it's something, when I used to be a makeup artist, I'd work with the actors, maybe for the first time, the lead role on the film, it'd be the first time they'd been on set.
Yeah.
And I used to think, you poor loves, you're giving yourself such a hill to climb, because not only are you carrying the film, but you're, you know, you really don't know where the light is, the camera is, or who's who or what's what.
That might help you, though, you know what I mean, is that... You might look back and think, how the hell did I do that?
Sheer terror.
But no, I did it in a step-by-step, you know, literally, you know, whilst all the time expecting something to land in my lap. But I couldn't stand The Bill. I couldn't stand how quick we were supposed to work. And, you know, compared with the theatre and everything, the turnover was ridiculous. There was no rehearsal. It was just get the lines in the right order and don't bump into the furniture, and that was that. And the part was okay for a while. I was playing a racist policeman called PC Muswell, and there was a black actor was also cast alongside me, and that was supposed to give the cop show a little bit of frisson of British reality. But in the end, it just couldn't sustain over 12 episodes, and I left at the end of that series, and they said, please come back and do a death scene, or do a scene where you'll end up in a wheelchair, and they'd written this scenario out, and I said, okay, I will, but I want the same money as the two lead guys are getting, because by then I worked out what they were getting. And they just said no. So I just said, well,
you just faded away. Your character did.
Yeah,
disappeared.
Yeah. And that was fine.
So what was the one...
I pissed some people off, which is probably stupid, but I just wasn't really aware of that kind of thing in those days either. Yeah, I think when I was young, I was quite rude and quite sort of ignorant, really.
And what was the exception on the going to the provinces in theatre?
Glenn Wolford offered me Macbeth in Liverpool at the Everyman Theatre, playing the lead.
Lovely.
And I did it, and it's the worst thing I've ever done.
Oh, really? Why?
Because she's an absolute cow.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. She can't direct to save her life. We had 2.5 to 3 weeks rehearsal, which wasn't enough. She wouldn't let me rehearse with the script, so she would shout the lines out and then I'd have to repeat them. I remember, just a few examples, I remember asking her after the dagger speech, when do Lady Macbeth and I decide to kill Duncan? Because there's nothing in the text that actually says, shall we kill Duncan? Yes, let's. It's not like that. It's very much more illiterate. And there isn't a definite point where you go, oh, hang on, they've decided to do murder there. It's just, there isn't a point. It's very, very vague. So I said, you know, which line should we kind of use to kind of... Oh, don't give me any of that psychological bollocks, Ralph. That was the first indication that things were not as they should be. And once we opened, I stopped taking her notes and I kind of clawed the play back for myself, one line at a time, and it took me 4 weeks. And on the last day of the fourth week, it was mine, all mine. And that was the best performance I'd ever given in my life. Luckily, my dad was there. And, you know, we had woolen costumes. We were supposed to be in a pond for half the play. Wool plus water, not a brilliant idea. You know, there were twigs and trees on the set, which kind of snagged at the wool as well. So the whole thing was an absolute nightmare. And it put me off the theatre, and I said, I would never, ever appear on stage again after that. I did, in fact, do one play at the RSC because I was broke and I had to do work. But that was, to all intents and purposes, the last time I was on stage. It was 1989 was the RSC one, so nearly 20
years. Even though you'd had so many good experiences up to that point?
Yeah.
You just had enough.
It just crystallised my own feelings about what I wanted to do as an actor, and it was definitely not that. And I remember some people coming, even after 2 or 3 weeks. Ken Sharrock, who was in West with me, came, because he was a Scouser, so he was in Liverpool, and he sat very near the front, and he said, you know what, Ralph, I couldn't see what you were doing, he said, until you came to the front of the stage, and then I could see you were doing it all, but it just was too small. And I was very pleased that he actually was brave enough to say that to me, because it indicated that theatre wasn't for me. Despite Berkoff, you know, because Berkoff actually pulls a performance out of you. He actually literally reaches down your throat and grabs it and pulls
like
it out.
Like the rock
and you,
valley,
and
yeah.
And you have to expand into the space. Most directors aren't capable of doing that. They wouldn't even know where to start. Danny Boyle didn't direct me at all, not a single line. You just had to come up with your own performance. And so but all the other actors, having been to drama school, of course, did, and I didn't. And that was my first kind of, I think, disappointment as well. And people at Sydney and West thought, well, what's he doing in there? We thought he was good, and he's not that good, really. But it was because I just didn't have the tools. I didn't know what I was supposed to do, and I need directors to help me, you know. I don't now, but I did then.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
For sure.
You hadn't got the training. Okay, well, let's put a little break in that one.